know how your body, like viscerally, you feel danger. I knew I was in danger when I opened the door to these men. And I said I didn't know how to get out. So I said I was going to walk the dog. And he said, I'll come with you. And so this actually happened outside.
You're listening to Alchemical Voices, a podcast exploring the lives of BIPOC, transracial adoptees, and survivors of complex trauma. Hi, I'm Jaslyn, your host, a nurse, and trauma release practitioner, curiously observing the human experience. As a Black woman and survivor of human trafficking, I've encountered many, many hardships. On the road to recovery, I discovered that storytelling unites us at heart and is where we find healing, inspiration, and encouragement. In each episode, you'll hear stories from courageous souls, and we will touch on subjects such as identity confusion, the impacts of racism, complex trauma, transracial adoption, and much more. How do we rise amid trials and tribulations? How do we invite softness into our lives? We touch on these and many other questions, so tune in to experience transformative storytelling and let's heal together. Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Alchemical Voices podcast. Today I have Bibi Gabrielle in the studio. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling many different feelings. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm feeling excited, and I'm feeling ready, but also, yeah, all the feels.
Yeah. So Bibi, first of all, may I ask, what is it that you would like to share today, and how would you like to start?
So as I've shared with you, I experienced a domestic violence relationship experience when I was quite a bit younger. So I would like to kind of talk about how I therapized myself through that experience, but also the things, maybe to touch on some of the things that led up to that and some of the things that have happened since that continue the experience, like the triggers that kind of take place, even though it's been over 20 years since I've escaped from that relationship. I still have things that come up, not every day, but certainly more often than I would like, that kind of take me right back there. And yeah, what I did to kind of, like I said, heal myself and turn it into something to hopefully help others. So I'll just, I wrote a book. I'll kind of touch on what I'm about to say hopefully later, but I'm calling it a fictionalized memoir. That's kind of a sensitive topic for me, but I'll come back to that after. But at the end of the book, I have a little author's note, and I thought it really does a great job, I think, of explaining my why and my when and my how. So yeah, I'll just read that quick and then dive into our interview. When I was first physically free of him, the traumatic memories kept me hostage. Even the smallest reminders held the power to unravel me. Seeing a blue Cavalier triggered a panic attack. Hearing our song or his first name led to an uncontrollable rage. Being touched or even just brushed up against activated vivid flashbacks. The smell of cigarette smoke or the cologne he wore caused me to vomit, and the taste of orange flavoring made me burst into tears. I found myself trapped in a constant state of hypervigilance. I tried my best to just forget the memories and avoid their triggers. I finally had a panic attack so severe that I was taken to hospitalized actually, diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, and prescribed medication that helped to numb me. I still didn't tell anyone anything that had happened to me. Had I likely would have been more appropriately diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. My trauma psychoeducation began in my second year university when I was accepted into the School of Social Work. I learned about domestic violence, trauma, and post-traumatic stress disorder. I learned about trauma theory and trauma-informed practice. I learned about various treatment modalities like cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure therapy, narrative therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, creative arts therapy, and experiential therapy. I decided to confront and overcome my own distressing memories through storytelling and by turning my trauma narrative into case studies to essentially therapize myself throughout the completion of my undergraduate and graduate degrees. I expanded upon my trauma narrative over many years. I wrote and rewrote, read and reread, each time adding more detail until it became easier to write, read, and eventually share. Sharing my story has helped me to reprocess my experience of domestic violence from a safe place, gifting me mastery and control over my traumatic past. Much like keeping a diary, writing my traumatic narrative all those years ago was, in a way, albeit unknowingly, like writing a letter to my future self, an older, stronger, wiser, kinder, and more compassionate version of me. Writing about the horrors I experienced at the hands and from the mouth of my ex proved extremely therapeutic. Writing helped to lessen the emotional pressure and the impact of the traumatic experiences by reducing the intensity of my trauma reactions. And years later, when I was healed enough, I started rereading it all and writing back. In response to my trauma narrative, I wrote letters to my younger self. This helped me process and work through my inner conflict to heal the wounded and traumatized younger parts of myself. I showed kindness and compassion to her. I reflected on the difficult times my younger self experienced, and I became the person now who she so desperately needed back then. I told her now what she needed to hear then. I considered how she and her trying experiences have positively shaped the current version of myself and expressed gratitude to her for the painful but essential learnings. I acknowledged and created space for the significant emotions she experienced: regret, pain, heartbreak, trauma, fear, shame, guilt, and grief. I shared with her the invaluable lessons I have since learned, the priceless insight I have since gained, and I offered her advice to help support and love her through the tough times ahead. I took the time to remind my younger self that she is worthy of being loved and not to doubt her self-worth. I shared with her all the qualities I appreciate and admire about her. I touched on her strength and resilience. I told my younger self how proud I am of her. I let her in on the life secret she has let to yearn, learn, that she gets to choose the ending of her story. I told her I'm her biggest fan. And then, when I felt fully healed myself, I decided to write this book for my younger family. So here we are, and here it is, my story, this novel for you.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was also what you added in the application, right? Yeah, I was like, I've read this before somewhere.
Yeah, that was the application.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's very beautiful. There's something profoundly healing about reconnecting with your inner child and taking care of her. That's something very special. Is there any way in your story you would like to start?
I would say, so the title of my book is No Ordinary Love. And I just want to highlight how that transformed over time, because it first started because that was the name of our song that he gave me, and just how, like, no ordinary love and abuse. Like, yeah, that sounds, I don't think most people think of it that way, but that's what it was for me. And then over time, though, as I wrote and read and reread and rewrote and everything else, it actually transformed to be the no ordinary love of my family and my relationship with my family. And as I had said in what I just read, it started out that I wanted to write what happened to me for my family, because I wanted them to understand what happened to me all those years ago, because it definitely caused conflict between us, and I was separated from them for a long time. And he did things to reinforce that they never knew, because I couldn't talk about it. I mean, it's over 20 years ago now, and this is probably the first time I've verbally out loud talked about it, aside from writing it in my book. Yeah. So you're probably the first person that's really heard these words come out of my actual mouth. So yeah, then the title kind of became more about, like, screw you to him. Like, look at what I have and where I came from, and you tried to destroy it and you couldn't, and the no ordinary love of my family. And part of that was my little sister was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and I had been writing on and off, picking it up, putting it down, picking it up, putting it down for over a decade. And when she got that diagnosis, I thought, holy crap. Like, I thought I had to get it written before my parents passed, because that's how we expect things to go. But here's my little baby sister who's going to die, and I really want this story to be done. And so in my book, I talk about that time period of like really connecting with my family at a totally different level. And spoiler alert, I did not get done in time. My sister unfortunately passed. But I believe that,
I'm sorry.
yeah, thanks. But I believe that she is around me and she knows and she's helping to push me forward and get it done anyway. And that's one of the things she said to me the night that she died was, "It'll never be too late. Just get it done. It'll never be too late." So the title, No Ordinary Love, morphed into that about my family. And then honestly, by the time I was done, it was like, well, yeah, but you know what? It's also the no ordinary love of myself and all parts of me, because my story, as I kind of read in the author's note, what I did was I actually externalized the parts of myself that I didn't like, that I didn't understand, that I blamed, and I called them a different name. And then in my undergraduate and eventually graduate degrees, I would use them as kind of standardized clients, and use their case stories to kind of pick apart and unpack and assess and then treat. And so really, it's come full circle with this no ordinary love of myself and all parts of me, you know? So yeah, I just wanted to say that part before we got into the actual story, but
Yeah, thank you so much. And oh my goodness, I mean, that is incredible what you did. You used yourself in, as study cases. That's brilliant. You were your own healer. You were the alchemist. I mean, high five, Queen. That's absolutely incredible.
Thank you. I will
Brilliant.
say a couple like words for caution about that though. Although it is true that I never to this day actually ever seeked professional therapy for this. I've had lots of therapy as a therapist myself, but not for the violence ever. I did have some support in helping to prepare my mom to read this story. We had a therapy session together before we read my book out loud together. But about the actual abuse I went through, I've never had any therapy. Now, I guess I'm not saying for or against. I think it's really important to do the work, but for me, I was going into that field anyway, and that was just how it started. It just started by me getting it out on paper. And I will say though, what I didn't realize until honestly just a couple of weeks ago, which is shocking to me, is that when I was in my doing my undergrad, it was over 20 years ago, and we didn't have content trigger warnings. We didn't have, you know, and so as I was learning about what I had experienced and realizing, oh my gosh, this didn't just happen to me. There's a whole community of people out there who went through what I went through. I didn't have, I didn't have the warnings or I didn't even have when I was technically disclosing through paper writing to my professors, not a single one ever actually checked in and was like, "Are you okay? Like, is this about you?" And in fact, I started submitting a bunch of what you call them, like extensions that I was getting from the hospital and from doctors because I had been hospitalized. I was on all this medication they were trying to sort out because it kind of like my learning, I took on too much too fast and I didn't have a safety net around me, right? And so I kind of spiraled and I didn't even connect all that together that I just didn't have what I needed in that moment. But funny thing about the university professor is the foreword in my book is actually the university professor that I first kind technically disclosed to. I didn't say, "Hi, this is me and I went through this," but she's the first person that I wrote about to. And I actually found her and connected with her and wrote out to her and asked her if she would read my book and consider writing a foreword for me. And this, I know people online can't hear, but this is the one of the papers to her that I wrote
Oh my
after my
goodness.
experience. And
Wow.
you saw the date, that's 2005, so exactly 20 years ago.
Yeah, I just saw it. I was like, oh my, that's full circle.
Yeah, full circle.
Full circle, baby.
Isn't that beautiful though?
Yes, absolutely, it's beautiful. Wow.
So that's that. I would say yes, I did therapize myself, but I could have used some more support, that's for sure. I just didn't know how to, I didn't have the words. I didn't have the words. There was so much blame and so much shame and so much, like, it was just such a mess, and I was learning just kind of by fluke about these things at the same time. And I just, I'm an overachiever and I'm A type, and I just like put myself into it and did everything I could, and there was a cost for that for sure, but thankfully I came out on the other side of that. So
Yeah, and you know what? Surviving complex trauma and getting quote unquote through it, I don't really know what word to use. I actually don't believe in being fully healed because I believe healing is a journey and not a destination. But my experience as a complex trauma survivor, so I didn't know what the hell was going on throughout my entire childhood. I had no idea what was going on throughout my 20s. I was in my mid-30s before things began, like, oh, this is what it is. Oh, this is the name for the thing I've been experiencing the last 20 years. So I say all that just to say, I think it's very common. None of us know what on earth is happening, what on earth is going on. And we all just try our different ways to get through it and manage it. And I just think it's so incredibly phenomenal and beautiful that you were like, well, I mean, I'm studying, I'm going to use the parts of me, dissect yourself essentially, and then use them as study cases and analyze them. I mean, what a brilliant brain.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, that was your way, you know, and I had my way, and someone had their way, and we all do the best that we can until we find better ways. And maybe in some years, you're like, no, you know what? I really do need to speak with a therapist about this. And then that's great, you know? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because in preparing for something like this, chatting with you on a podcast, I'd shared with you before you started recording that I have come up with like different topics I can speak to in depth, and I've kind of like broken down what I can talk about. And I think it's in some of those things where I see that, oh yeah, there's more work that can be done here. But also, I think for me, I agree with you, healing is a journey. I also agree, I don't think you're ever like fully through it, even though I know I said that, but I agree with you. But it's just in writing this too, it's all definitely come back more than would be typical because I'm spending so much time on it, right? So
Yeah, there is something very therapeutic about writing about what you've been through. I'm also writing a memoir, and for the longest time, I had to stop looking at it for several years because when I would write, especially about my childhood, I would end up going into full blown rage, and I would be screaming and smashing my hands in the table. I would lose it, and I would get flashbacks. So I was like, I'm not there yet. Why I can write this? I need
100%.
trauma therapy.
100%. And I'm so thank you for sharing that, because part of my many struggles through this has been that people are like, what's taking so long? Like, what, you're still writing? It's not a, you can just upload it to Amazon, like you took a whole year off. I didn't take a year off. I watched my sister suffocate to death. So I was put off for a year, and because I'm an overachiever, I didn't want to waste the time, so I spent that time writing. But like you said, I had to pick it up and put it down. I had to, there's just so much that I feel like, unless, unfortunately, unless you've been through something, a traumatic experience like this, or multiples, right? It's really hard for people to understand. And that's part of what I wanted to do with my book too. I want it to be a place where, or like a reading experience where other survivors can be like, me too, that I want them to feel seen and feel heard, feel believed. But I also want it to be a place for people who have been lucky enough to not have experienced the perfect storm, for them to be like, oh, I get it. And that was actually very re-traumatizing for me throughout it, was actually once it got to the point of critiquers and beta readers and editors and my publisher, and I had to get a lawyer because people really weren't getting it still. And so then I found myself defending myself and my truth and my experience to these people who like didn't have a clue. And you know, sometimes this what I'm about to share works for me and sometimes it doesn't, but what I've tried to do, the tool that I've tried to use, is just when people don't get it, I just they're lucky, you know. Like I almost like there's no other way to look at it, but well, then be lucky that you don't get it. You know what I mean? What a place of privilege really to not get that. My relationship, I was underage. I was 17 years old, and my partner was 31 years old. And part of what I've struggled with over the years, and when I said earlier, like, oh, that's something I could work on in therapy now, is this weird flip-flopping that I do between defending myself to say I was just a child and defending not him so much, but essentially it's an internalized him to say, well, you were almost 18. You were 6 months away from being 18. Like some arbitrary date on the calendar just clicks it into being okay. Do you know what I mean? And let's not forget that age is just one part of it, this age gap. That doesn't even touch on the abuse, regardless of if we were the same age, right? And so it's this weird thing where, you know, and I've heard some of your other podcast guests say the same thing. Like, it's this weird thing of, well, it wasn't as bad, or, well, I was almost 18, or, well, I was lucky enough to have a fairly amazing childhood aside from not feeling loved. And so then I went and looked for love in any desperate place where I could get it. But because I didn't have like childhood big T trauma, then it doesn't count for me. Like all these things that we do to minimize and really, you know, and blame ourselves and discredit our experience, and this comparing that we do, like that's been hard.
And as you just so beautifully, said yourself, it was that lack of love in your childhood that essentially led you into a very abusive relationship. Let's dive into the story. How did you meet him? What happened? And if you want, maybe what happened in your childhood? I mean, you shared it very briefly, but would you like to just so we have an idea of what led you to this monster?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, thank you.
So the childhood piece, I mean, honestly, like I truly come from an amazing family. They're like everyone else, they're human and just doing the best they can with what they know. However, I was like, I have always been the emotional one in my family. I've always had these really big feelings, and like I just felt like I didn't know what to do with them, and neither did anyone in my family. And so I really lacked a sense of belonging and of love. It felt like nothing I ever did was good enough. And my family, we had a big move when I was at the end of my grade 8 year, a couple months before high school. And my husband rolls his eyes every time I say this, but it's the truth. That devastated me. Like to this day, I'm 42 years old, and to this day, that has impacted my life and how I view relationships. And so that's no fault of my parents. They just moved, you know, like it happened. But for me, it was a big deal. And so when we moved to this new place, I was bullied for the first time in my life. I'd never been bullied before. And my parents were going through their own issue. My dad was had some infidelity, and I didn't know that I was a child, but my mom was not available to me because she was dealing with her own experience. And then I'm in this new school where I'm getting bullied. And then we were 2 months in the summer with no friends at all in the middle of 108 acres. I moved from the city to the country. And then high school was rough for me too. And I just wanted to feel like I belonged. And nobody was nice to me, not the girls, not the boys, until the boys started getting interested. And so I had a handful of experiences of, I mean, you could call them anywhere from soft core sexual assaults, really, of these boys who just wanted one thing, and I just wanted to be loved. And so this kind of paved the way to me not being accepted in my high school at all. And I ended up finding at a party this acceptance from kids who lived like in town. My high school is on the outside of town, and but in the town, these were where kids had dropped out or never graduated high school, or and they loved me. And I really felt like I belonged, but they were a lot older than me, most of them. And so I left home initially at 16, and I lived with a 23-year-old. And all of her friends were, if not her age, even older than her. And so nobody expected a 16-year-old to be hanging out with people in their mid-20s. And so I got into the bar no problem because people just didn't expect that these crew that they had known, they just thought I was the new girl, which I was. I'd moved there. And so when I met him, what ended up happening was I had no idea how old he was. It's not like you get on a date and you're like, here's my ID, check out our information. I just assumed, well, he looks a couple years older than the girl I used to live with, and she was 23, so that makes him maybe 9 years older than me. And my parents are 9 years apart, so that's got to be a sign, right? And that's kind of how it started. And by the time I found out he was 31, I mean, I'll be honest with you, at the time, I don't think it fazed me at all. Like, I had found my people. I had found this sense of belonging. I had found the first man who didn't totally take advantage of my desperation for love and connection, or so I thought.
I was just about to say, or so you
Yeah,
thought.
or so I thought. Yeah. And, you know, I'll say this, but I have a quick correction to it after. I've always said, and I say in my book, you know, 90% of the time, it really felt like a fairy tale. I really felt like, wow, this is amazing. And that 10% was potentially fatal on many occasions. And I recently saw a meme where, well, I hate saying meme if it's not funny, but you know what I mean, a post. And it said, even if 90% was wonderful and 10% was horrific, it is still abuse. And I'm like, yeah, it was. Like, imagine if every 10 days you had an abusive entire day, like, yeah, of course. But in the moment, I mean, he did such a great job of turning every, like, gaslighting me. And like, even to my age, like, he was the Phoebophile. He, him, and he continued to be long after me. So trust me, I'm not just saying that because of his one relationship with me. He continued on to be 38 and impregnating a 15-year-old. So trust me, he's an ephebophile. But like, he would use my age against me. He would say I was just too young to understand, or I didn't understand what love actually was. And that's part of why even now I find myself flip-flopping between I was just a child and no, I was mature for my age, you know? And so, yeah, he very quickly isolated me from everyone I knew, including my parents, as soon as I expressed that I missed them and wanted to try to, you know, make a bridge with them and have a relationship with them. That's when he started feeling threatened. And that's when the abuse started. That's when he would threaten to kill them. The first thing he actually did was he robbed them. So he went, when he was moving me out of my house, like literally my belongings, and then I went to school, he had my keys and went back to my house with a friend and robbed my parents. So they did not know until many years after I wasn't even with him anymore that it wasn't me. And to be honest, To be really honest, I don't think that they still believe that it wasn't me. I still think to this day, even with my mom having read my entire book with me, page by page, I still don't think that my family fully believes that I did not have any part of him robbing them blind. So he created this conflict where now they are upset with me and they blame me. They have no idea what's going on behind closed doors. And so that was the first sever where I didn't feel like I had the availability to go home. I also, my parents knew, they didn't know exactly how old he was, but they knew he was not age appropriate. And so I felt like if I did ask for help, then I was going to get the I told you so's, or you should have known better. And when the abuse against me kind of started to not necessarily work so much anymore, and I was always really, adults always loved me, even though I struggled with my mom. Adults always really loved me, and I had parents, friends who were trying to support me. And so he put an end to that by murdering our cat and said, "I am a killer, and look what I did. And I'm telling you for the last time, if you fucking leave me, I will murder you and your family." Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. It's just because my brain needs to catch up.
Yeah.
So while you were at what was it, high school, college, whatever, he took your key, went into your home, and got your parents' keys, robbed the house. Was jealous, didn't want you to have a relationship with your parents or with any other adults. So to control and threaten you, he was like, "This is what I'm capable of. So if you don't listen, it will be your family and you." Is that right?
Yes,
Oh my God.
mostly. The only thing that it was my fault is I did move home for a short while after living with a 23-year-old. I moved home for about a year and repaired things with my family. And then when I met him, I moved out again. So yeah, that's the only thing. But yes, everything else, yes. And so he also was trying to, and I didn't realize this, of course, for years after what he was doing, but he didn't allow us to have a landline phone. Only he had a cell phone. He didn't let me hang out with any of my friends because they were filthy sluts who would get me attention from men. And eventually, when around the time of the cat situation, he said, "We're going to move to the other side of the country." So I'm from Ontario. He said, "We're moving to BC." And I said, "I don't want to move to BC." I was already terrified. I was already so lonely, even though I was proximity-wise, I was close to everyone I knew, but I just didn't have a connection with them anymore. And he said, "Yeah, you're moving with me. And like it or not, you're coming." And he sold all of mostly my stuff, shipped what I needed out there without me knowing. And after he killed my cat, came home with a Greyhound bus ticket to be leaving a couple days after that.
Oh my God. I mean, were you not absolutely terrified of him?
Yeah, I was absolutely.
Terrified. I mean, how was it for you to share a bed with him and go to sleep each evening? I would be terrified that he would kill me while I was sleeping.
Well, honestly, like first of all, it was a long time ago. So, and I try, there are some things you try not to remember, but it was so Jekyll and Hyde. Like he didn't have to be like that very often for it to scare me for a long period of time. Do you know what I'm saying? So like what I try to explain to people, it's not that a lot of things don't happen in my story and in the book I wrote, they do, but there's actually nothing more than what I've shared in my book, if that makes sense. He only had to do things the odd time every month or two or six or however long it was to keep me controlled. And then as soon as I was scared enough, he would go back to being this wonderful, great person who everyone loved, and I would see the parts of him I loved too. Like it was a different person. It was totally a different person. And then I would just learn what not to do the next time. So, okay, I won't spend the night at my friend's house with her mom. I won't have, another cat. I won't do this or that. As long as I don't do these things, then that won't happen to me, right? Like that was the messaging. And I didn't know up from down. And I mean, I knew right from wrong, I guess, but kind of not too, because I just, it was so far out of anything that I'd ever experienced in my life that it felt like I was in the twilight zone. And so, yeah, so we moved to the other side of the country. And honestly, over there, things got better for a bit. I mean, I didn't have any friends or family. We didn't have a phone again. Well, he ended up getting one, but put a long distance block. So this was back when long distance was still a thing, and I couldn't contact anybody. And I got two jobs and just put my head down. And I thought, I'm going to save every paycheck from these jobs and get out when I can. But he would confiscate the money because this was back in the day when we had physical checks that you would have to go and get cash, and he would accompany me and take the money and give me an allowance out of it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was.
He's textbook narcissist. This
Yeah.
is like textbook narcissism, everything you've said so far. My goodness.
Yeah, it's awful.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it took me a long time to make sense of it. It, like, one thing I didn't even mention that happened very early on before any other, like, before he was ever physically violent, was I was raped at gunpoint by his like by the gang leader of a person that he got drugs from. And that devastated me. That was the first time I tried to reach out for help. I wrote an assignment to my teacher. Oh, interesting. I just figured out that's actually quite like I did in university. But anyway, I did it to my teacher, high school teacher, and it was this convoluted story of, well, it was a rape, but I worked it into a high school assignment about gods and goddesses. And she did ask me if I needed help. And by the time she'd read it, I had changed my mind and I was scared again. And anyway, when I confronted my boyfriend about the rape, because I had a feeling, I felt guilty about it because it felt like I had cheated on him, even though I was raped at gunpoint. But I also, like, I didn't want him finding out. These people were still around sometimes. And so I told him, and he and I broke down. And he literally said to me that he didn't blame me or something. I forget exactly. He didn't, it's not, he didn't say it wasn't my fault, but he said, I'm not mad at you. I'm not mad at you. Now, tidy yourself up, because we were driving on our way to friends' houses and or house. And he said, clean yourself up. We don't need anyone else knowing what you've done.
What?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You were held at bloody gunpoint, raped by his drug dealer or someone in that community, and he had the audacity to say, no one needs to know what you did.
Yeah, so I didn't understand that at first, as nobody would, but he clarified what he meant a couple of months later when we were on the bus to BC. He admitted that he had that done to me. He owed a big drug debt, and he made a deal with the leader of this gang that it would be wiped in exchange for him giving him access to me.
Holy, I am blown. I need 1 second to just what? I just need a minute. First of all, I'm so sorry. I'm so in shock right now. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I need to understand. Have I understood this correctly? Your partner had arranged for you to be raped and held at gunpoint.
He told this the leader of this gang, and he had a few of his gang members with him. He told them when he was going to not be home. And they came to my house. And I was like, that's weird, because I knew that, I forget how I knew this, but I knew that they knew he wasn't going to be home. And he knew that they were coming, and they knew he wasn't going to be home. So I was already confused as to why these people were showing up. And I
Yeah.
felt, you know, how your body, like, viscerally, you feel danger. I knew I was in danger when I opened the door to these men. And I said, I didn't know how to get out. So I said, I was going to walk the dog. And he said, I'll come with you. And so this actually happened outside under a bridge in the middle of the winter in Canada. I'm sure you're, and And yeah, and then I told my partner, and he made that dismissive comment that he wasn't mad at me, and to clean myself, like my face up, because I was crying. And we'd never talked about it again because, well, I was so confused. And it wasn't until months later than that, maybe 6 months later, that we were on our way to British Columbia. And it was another, he was admitting what he had done because it was a control thing. Like, if you step out of line, do you know the people I know? Do you know what I have no problem having done to you? He made that threat a lot, that he would take me to like a clubhouse and have me trained if the only men who were going to fuck me were men that he made fuck me.
What an absolute nut job. I
Yeah.
am so sorry. Have you ever spoken with a therapist about this particular part of your story?
No.
I mean, as someone that's been held at gunpoint myself, and I was not raped in that specific situation, that was highly traumatizing. And then I was many years prior to that incident, I was raped. That was also extremely traumatizing. So you have like got double up on something extremely, two things that are very traumatizing at once, and you've not spoken about it. My
And
God.
I know that there's a place to do it. I just like, yeah, it's hard because it has negatively, as you can imagine, impacted my sex life.
Yeah.
But I worry that opening that up, like, because I've compartmentalized it, I worry that opening that up would only further damage what I've been able to
Yeah.
get back. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, is it worth
Yeah.
it? I mean, I don't know. Like, the therapist in me says, yes, it's worth it, do it. But then
Yeah.
me, who has survived it and maintained this amazing relationship and marriage and what I can of, a sex life, it's like,
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if it's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you. I get what you're saying. I get both perspectives, and I'm a firm believer that we know when and if we're ready. I think you know what I mean when I say that. There are some things in life you'll never be ready, but I believe that we can sense, no, something is off. I got to deal with it. And then, well, being so self-aware that you are, you'll probably sense that this is the rape, this is that incident that is somehow messing with me. I need to deal with. Do you get what I'm saying? And that's when you'll quote unquote are ready.
I think it's also kind of like prioritizing what I need to do first. Like,
Yeah.
it's been over 20 years, but like for me, first and foremost, obviously, was safety. And then next was reconnecting with my family. And that took
Yeah.
forever, literally
Yeah.
forever. And then it was starting to, write it out. And then it was, and so I'm not opposed to one day getting professional support for some of these things. It just wasn't in, it hasn't been in the queue yet. It hasn't come up yet.
Yeah. I get that. It's also a lot. I mean, it's a absolutely insane relationship that I want to hear more about. Then there's this mind-blowing what the fuck situation in the middle of it. Then you got out of it somehow, and he kept har he har that's when he really started harassing you, as I understood it. Then you started to write about it, and then there's the whole thing with your sister, and that in itself is absolutely heartbreaking. So there's just been one thing after the other, right?
Yeah, and it's
So
like part of it is like, how much time do you dedicate? It feels like, how much time do you dedicate to him, really? So I try to protect my time. Like, yes, this is important to me, and yes, I want to write about it and share it and be there for other survivors and do my own work, absolutely. And I want to live in my life with the love of my life and enjoy my life and focus on the present and the future. And so I have to
yeah.
I've had to really pick and choose like how much time I spend in each place, because you can also spend too much time in the past. And
Yeah, absolutely. And it can bring you down, you know. I get it. I get it. And I'm a firm believer whatever is right for us, we will end up doing that. You know, so if it's right for you to work through that horrific incident, you will. And I also think that a loving relationship, so you're in a beautiful, loving marriage where you feel safe now, I believe that that also can do a lot of healing on a subconscious level. So the healing is likely happening without you even having to, quote unquote, put tons of effort into it because you are around a man that is safe and that loves you, you know, and that in itself is medicine.
And loves all parts of me, the good, the bad, and the
Yeah, and that's the kind of love that we want, damn it.
ugly. Absolutely.
Okay, so back to you're on this bus in BC. He tells you that, yeah, I planned this. This is what I'm capable of. And then what?
And then we arrived in BC. We were supposed to, this was terrifying for me. We were supposed to live in a grow op. Like now marijuana is legal in Canada, but it certainly wasn't then. We were supposed to live in this grow op and take care of the plants in exchange for like free accommodation. But as soon as we got there, my partner and the person in charge of this got into it, did not like each other, rubbed each other the wrong way. And so we were out of a place to live. And so, oh God, I'm trying to not make this last forever. He ended up securing housing for us, which I found out when it all ended that he had actually just like made himself a self he self-appointed himself as the landlord of the building, but really it's because it had been abandoned. The owner of it had been in a near fatal car collision, and he had found out because we'd walked by this unit and it looked like there was vacancy and he didn't see any signs. So he talked to one of the few remaining tenants there, and she'd said, yeah, like the landlord hasn't come for the rent or but something about the rent in months now. But here's the number. And my partner got in touch with her son, I guess, and found this out and said, oh, well, like I'll manage it in the meantime and I'll save the money and no problem, but I'm not going to give it to you because you're not on title. But as soon as your mom's well enough, I'll save it all up for her. So luckily for us, I guess at the time, we moved into this place and he got busy managing that. And I got two jobs to kind of keep my head down. And honestly, things were normal, like okay for quite a while. And then really for him, it was when he was drinking. So if he was on drugs, I was safer than I could possibly be. If he was sober, also safe. But if he was on alcohol, oh my gosh, for sure it was going to be a nightmare. And so, yeah, it just kind of started happening slowly every once in a very long while. And then it started cycling, the cycle got quicker, and I knew I needed to get out, and I had to reconnect with my family. And it was actually a blessing in disguise, I guess. My grandfather died, and I had been in contact with my grandma, and so she had given my mom my phone number, and she called to say that my grandfather had died, and did I want to come home for the funeral? And I was very close with my grandparents, and that was devastating to me. So I said yes, and she offered to buy my flights, plural. And I couldn't just trauma dump everything, and she wouldn't have understood, or she wouldn't have had any idea what to do with that. So I went home for the funeral, and I used that as an opportunity to start connecting with my family and telling them I was going to get back into school because he made me drop out of high school, that I was going to get back on the right path, that I wanted to come home. I kind of put out the feelers for that, and then went back to BC, finished my last like grade 12 English course that I needed for a credit, and just bided my time because I knew that I couldn't leave him. I knew that I had to either make it his idea, which didn't seem to be happening, or I had to try to convince him that he was choosing not to return to Ontario with me as opposed to I was choosing to leave him. And so I planted the seed that I wanted to go back to my home province because I wanted to go to university. And at the time, we had what's called OACs. There's like a grade 13. It's gone now, but we had it then, and I needed to do that. And only my province still had it. BC had already gotten rid of it. And so I tried to use that to say, I have to go home. I really want to go to university. I need to get this grade 13. Come with me. But I knew he wouldn't. And so I planted the seed for about 6 months that it was his idea to not come with me, not my idea to leave him. And in that time, he started spiraling more and more, the more he realized that he didn't have control over me anymore. And so that led to what ended up being the worst beating of my relationship with him. I'm lucky I didn't die. He strangled me. I blacked out. I was black and blue, bleeding, you name it. And this sounds so wild, but it's the truth. When he would go on these benders, he would then be out of it, like sleeping and puking and whatever for 3, 4 days after. And I knew that that was a safe time for me. And when he kind of came to after the third or fourth day on this bender where he beat me almost to death, and when he kind of came to, I'd just come out of the shower and he saw what he'd done to me. And like, I'm not trying to give him an excuse. I'm not. But addict him was very different than sober him. And whether this is the truth or not, I choose to believe that sober him did have some capacity to be a good person and to show me better love. But addict him did not. And so when sober him saw me and my cuts and bruises and everything he'd done to me, he was devastated, which he often was after the fact, but not to this level. Like this was a new low. And so anyway, within days of I said I was going back home and I couldn't do this anymore, and he felt sad about it. And anyway, fast forward, it was about the next month, and he tried to convince me to not study for my exam. He tried to convince me to come away with him and do something fun. I said, I have to study for this exam. He said, oh, don't go to school. Like, just stay here with me. I said, no. And then he told me that he had a brain tumor and was given 8 months to live, which I was like, again, keep in mind, I was 19 at this time. It was just another like shock. I didn't know what to do. I'm a compassionate person. I'm like, what? You're dying? And so I tried to say, oh my gosh, tell me more. And then he got mad at me for like, I don't need you questioning me right now. Like, I'm dying for God's sakes, and you're leaving, like guilting me for leaving. And the next thing I know, he left. He said he was going to work. I realized within minutes that he had children like that he didn't see. He had pictures of them on the wall, three kids. And I noticed that the pictures were gone. And I went to call his cell phone to be like, come back, we need to talk about this. What do you mean you're dying? Where are your pictures? His cell phone was dead, like the cellular customer, you know that. And then I was like, what the heck? And so I went and I looked in the closet, only his favorite's gone. I looked in the bathroom, only his essential toiletry's gone. And I was like, oh my God, I think he's abandoned me. So it took me, I had less than 2 weeks. The owner was coming. So that is what started this. The owner was coming to collect the rent money of the year that he had been saving it. And I had to get out because I had no money for her. I wasn't collecting it. He was, apparently, and he was gone. And so I packed up and gave notice to my work and sold the furniture that we had for a plane ticket and got the hell home. And my parents knew I was coming and had said I could come back home. And I got home. I had been home not even quite 2 weeks, I think. And my friend looked like she saw a ghost behind me, and it was him. And he came over and said, oh, I'm so glad you finally are home, baby. I've missed you so much. Like, come on, come over to our friends. And I was what? Like, so many mind fucks, right? Like, and I was confused. I'm like, what? Like, in my head, I'm like, what? Like, I haven't heard from you. You abandoned me with like tens of thousands of dollars that you owed somebody. Like, what? And I came over to, I was just in shock and got pulled over to the different room where his friends were. And they were like, oh, so happy that you're finally back. He's been missing you so much. Like, anyway, the lie that he told everybody was that because we had two cats, he got me new ones. That's a whole other story. Because we had two cats and he had a car, he had to drive the car home, but he wasn't going to spend 5 days with cats in the car. So I had to fly home with the cats. And so anyway, it was a month or two-ish, I guess, not quite 2 months of me knowing I didn't want to be with him, but he was still telling me he was dying. And I felt bad for him because he's sleeping in his car. But I knew that if my parents knew I was talking to him, that wouldn't be okay. It was just this weird time of like, I thought I had escaped, but I haven't, but he's here. Anyway, soon enough, he had asked for all the things that I'd brought back. I paid to have like a skid put on a truck and bring some things back. And he said he wanted some of his things. And I thought, well, screw you. Like, you left them and you didn't pay to have them brought back. And, but whatever. So I said, sure. And then he left again. And I didn't see him for 5 months. Well, I thought forever. Got a new relationship. And then 5 months later, I have a knock on my door. My baby sister, the one that died, answered the door and said, you've got a guy here. I came up, saw him, said, what are you doing here? And she knew who that must have been then. And she said, if that's who I think it is, mom and dad said he's not allowed. And yeah, then it started this. It was about a month, I would say, of him harassing me, stalking me, calling my work, showing up at my partner's house, beating me up in the bar. He had Polaroids of me that I'd taken stupidly for him, naked ones, when I was 17 and 30 pounds underweight. He put them all up on the gate of my workplace for a good time call, my parents' phone number, just nonstop harassment. Proposed to me.
What?
Give me a ring, like, I mean, total wackadoodle, like totally insane. I didn't know again which way was up, which way was down. And like nobody got it. Like the people who thought they knew him, they're like, oh, we feel bad for him. Like he's never been like this over a girl. And I'm like, my life is in danger. Like this man is spiraling. His behavior had escalated to him doing things in public. He'd never done that before. He'd kept his abuse of me very private. This was very public, and I was scared. And then I already shared the rest with you. He kept trying to make me get back with him, brought out a ring. I still have it in my little box of letters, and tried to propose to me. And when I said no, yeah, whack-a-doodle noodle. When I said no. He thought up a plan to kill me, put it on paper, told one of our mutual friends when he was off his rocker on alcohol. And the thing that saved me for sure, first and foremost, was that he ended up attacking with weapons, attacking some people that had pissed him off at the bar he was leaving on his way to come to find me, and went to jail for that. But the police knew, they found this letter. They found this, it wasn't really I never saw it, but it wasn't a letter as much as it was like a plan that he'd written out of how to fuck me and then kill me, fuck me one last time and kill me. And so that was added into everything.
What an absolute fucking psychopath. So you were in a relationship, you had a new partner, and he was doing all these absolutely insane things. He planned to unalive you, and he told a friend, and it was this friend that called you and said, you need to hide, you need to get out of your home, you because he's coming for you.
And he said he's terrified of him. He was the same age as me. This was a friend of my age. And he said he was terrified of him. The reason he ended up there is because I was supposed to spend New Year's with that friend. And I made the mistake of telling my ex that I wasn't going to be around for New Year's. I was going to be with this friend he knew. And so he went to this friend's house. It was 2 hours away from where we lived. And because he thought I was going to be there. And when I wasn't there, and my friend said, like, no, she canceled last minute. She's going to hang out with her fr other friend. That's when he was already drunk and out of his mind, and So my friend like snuck away to make a call to say, I'm terrified of him. He even said to me, he's like, after this, he's like, we can't be friends. I can't be part of this. And that is exactly what kept me so afraid and so frozen for so long, was I didn't want this lunacy spilling out to any of my friends or family. I didn't want anybody else being in danger. That's what kept me so frozen and stuck. And so to hear a friend say to me, like, I can't know you anymore because he is such a psycho and I'm terrified for my own life, much less the fact that he just told me and I believe him that he wants to come and unalive you. Sorry, I forgot we're supposed to be careful these days.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, that was, and you know, I mean, story for another day, but that was just the very, well, it wasn't the very first, but that was the first of many examples of friends and family and strangers and coworkers like turning a blind eye and dismissing or it being too much for them. I'm like, well, I wish that I was hearing this and I didn't get it. Like it took many years for me to realize, like, when I did try to finally tell people that I thought were safe or that I thought could understand or help me, I would lose them because it was so big and it was so scary, like literally scary. So that kind of just reinforced my silence. Like I got a little brave and then I was like, nope, get back in there and be quiet about it. So yeah.
I cannot imagine. I just can't imagine. So what did you actually do when you had spoken with his friend or your friend? Where did you go? What did you do?
So this is the little bit that I said to you, I fictionalized in my story, like that I actually made a lie about in my story. So in my story, I said I called 911 and reported him, which I did not do, but the rest is true. He did get arrested because of the couple. But my friend that I had said I would spend New Year's Eve with, she her family lived even more in the country than, well, not more in the country, but we live in the middle of butt fart nowhere. And he had never been to her house, didn't have any idea where she lived. And so we went to her house to hide out. And I just anxiously awaited. I don't know what I would have done if he wasn't arrested by the police, but what ended up happening was I got a phone call from the same friend, my friend, and he said, or Sean in my story, but in real life, and he said, you're so lucky, like this is what happened. He, right as we were leaving to come get you, this couple upset him, he beat the living piss out of them with weapons, he was charged with aggravated assault, he was taken to jail, and they found the letter, they it, not a letter, but they found whatever chicken scratch he was making for his plan to unalive me and do what he was going to do to me first. And so he went to jail. And but then, like I said earlier, the story didn't end there. This lunatic wrote me letters from jail for years, and the story doesn't end there either because I ended up confronting him stupidly one time after I thought enough time had passed and I forgot how unsafe things were. And I wanted the letters to stop, and I also, though, this part of me wanted to like show him that I had done all the things he said I could never do. I had reconnected with my family. We were doing better than ever. I'd gone to university and gotten 2 degrees. I had my dream job. I was traveling. I was on my way to Australia to visit my middle sister who lived there at the time, had just moved there at the time. And I really wanted to be like, F you. I did all of this even after what you did to me. And, you know, liquid courage was involved and a crazy friend who I loved to death, but she didn't know what I had gone through. She just knew that he was writing me letters and couldn't let go. And so we drove. This was right after he was released. I had gotten a letter saying with a return address of a house, not the jail, not the prison. And I looked it up and saw that it was whatever 37 kilometers away from me. And I decided stupidly, obviously this is very stupid. I wish this didn't happen, but it did. I went to confront him, and At first, well, actually, the whole time I was there, he was like so happy and happy tears in his eyes, and he just couldn't believe it. And I was just boasting, like, oh, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this. And that fucker tried to take credit. He said something about, like, well, he wrote it in a letter after. He said, if he has to wonder what part he played in the amazing woman I had become, because if he hadn't done, and I'm like, what? Yeah, right.
What an
And
absolute.
narcissist, yeah. So then at one point, he kissed me. And I freaked out. Like, I freaked out. And as I pushed him off and said no, I noticed that he had a new tattoo on the whatever you call the back side of your palm. What do you call it? Whatever that part is.
Yeah, the backside. Yeah.
Back side of your palm. And it was the gang, like, what do you call it? Like the gang symbol of the gang who the leader he had raped me. And that was new. So that just instantly took me back to how much danger I was really in, how dangerous he was, how connected he was. It was like enough years had gone by, 4 years had gone by at that point. I hadn't, except for getting letters, I didn't have to see him. So in that moment, between him kissing me, between me seeing this new tattoo of the gang sign of the person that he had raped me, I realized, oh my gosh, like I just snapped into reality of like how much danger I was in. And so I said to my friend, we gotta go, we gotta go. And he's like, no, please don't leave, please. It's been so long. And I said, no, this was just closure. Like, we're good. And as I turned around to leave, because we had come in the same door that my back was against, so I hadn't seen the wall yet. As we went to leave, my friend and I gasped at the same time because above the windowsill, like above where the window ended and the door frame, were these blown up pictures of a 15-year-old me, 2 years before I ever even met him, that my little sister and I had taken goofy glamour shots with our dad's shirt and like seductive, sexy photos, you know, that some young people do. I had never given him those. I had never, he had found somewhere in my stuff and stolen them. And all these years later, at the time that this happened, he was 38 years old and he had a baby in the other room with a girl who hadn't even turned 18 yet, hadn't even turned 17 yet. And on the wall were these blown up pictures of a 15-year-old me. And I said, where did you get those from? And he said, you gave them to me. And we both know that wasn't true. So there's no sense in arguing with an insane person. And I said,
No.
you take those down before your girlfriend gets home. And he said, they've been there since before she left. Like, she needs to know her place. She needs to know that you will never be replaceable. And I was like, so I left, and the letters didn't stop, but they certainly started becoming less now that he wasn't in jail with nothing to do. And but still, for years after, he would try to reach out to me through Facebook, send our songs, send some cryptic things, say how much he missed me. But it was always in like this, like nothing had ever happened bad way. Like, oh, you should come around sometime. Like, I really miss seeing your cute face. Like, stuff like that. I'm like, what? So I was, you know, I spent decades still even second guessing myself and my reality and what actually happened and how do you make sense of somebody who you can't make sense out of, you know?
I mean, I'm not a nut job, so I don't know what goes on in a nut job's mind, but I do think that those mind games and that deception, I think it's a part of their delusion, but I also think it's to create cognitive dissonance and confusion. They thrive on us being confused, doubting ourselves, doubting our sanity, not really knowing what is going on. They thrive on us blaming ourselves because then they don't have to take accountability for being the fucking nut jobs that they are. So I mean, it makes a lot of sense that you would question yourself and like doubt what was actually real and what wasn't. And I get it and I see you. For me, it was very much about what is this? And could I have done something for it not to develop the way it did? So that's still blaming myself in a way. And I just think that that's natural, you know, and that's something that really has helped me is therapy. Just even, but even just our conversation, speaking with someone that's like listening and watching it from the outside, that can help you like correct that vision and be like, no, this was not you. This was never you. This person was completely insane, not well, you know? And I'm so confused. So he had already been in prison for what he did to these two other people. I'm so confused that he was not charged for planning to unalive you, and he was part of the rape that you lived through. He could be sentenced for that because he was complicit, because he knew of it. He planned it. He wasn't the one that did it, but he knew it was going to happen, so he's complicit. So I'm just wondering, did you ever get a straining no, what's it called?
No contact or restraining order,
Yeah.
emergency protective order. No, and part of it is, I would like to think that if this happened today, I would have known more things and done things differently. But this was in, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2004. I didn't even know what a social worker was. I went to school initially. I went to university for psychology by fluke, added on a social work course, and was like, oh my God, this is what I want to do with my life. I didn't know about, I was so sheltered to kind of the other side of life and experiences. And I didn't know, like, cops were called many times, once by me, many times by or not many, but a handful of times by neighbors. And at the time, and I hope things would be different now. I don't know. I haven't had to call the cops, but I wasn't told, here's a list of places to go and numbers to call. I wasn't told. I was told, well, we're going to take him to the drunk tank and you better not be home by the time he gets back. Like, be gone. I'm like, be gone where? I'm on the other side of the country from my family and I'm a teenager. Like, how do I be gone? I don't even have a long distance on my phone. Like, one of the things I talked about in my book was, or I didn't talk about, I just mentioned, is that, like, when I went home for my grandpa's funeral, my dad, I told them I didn't have long distance, and he got me a calling card. Well, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a calling card. You don't know what you don't know.
You
What I know
don't.
now is very, I know a lot now, but I didn't know these things, and nobody gave me those options then. I remember, like, one of the times, the time that he almost killed me in British Columbia, when the police came, I remember at that point that one of the officers was female and she was Polish, and her voice was so soothing and she was so beautiful, and that's just my memory of it. I felt very comfortable with her and safe. And I remember then being asked, like, if I wanted to press charges. And I was so afraid of him. I thought, you guys can't help me. Are you kidding me? You can't help me. And so that was when I very intentionally denied and said I tripped and I fell and I did this and I did that and whatever. And I'd already learned about that, because the first time when I called the police, the first and only time, he was strangling me and I didn't know what to do. So I tried to reach up and grab a picture off the wall and I brought it down on him and I cut his face. So when I called the police and they showed up, he was bleeding and I didn't have bruises yet. And they said, we'll dual charge you. You'll both get charged. So the one time I did call the police, I learned very quickly that, and he used that against me. I'll charge you. I'll charge
Of
you. And
course he did. Of course he did. Fucking bastard. Of course he did.
so yeah, to answer your question, no, I didn't know, I didn't even know what a restraining order was. Nobody suggested it, nobody offered it. And to be honest, depending on when, if somebody did offer it or suggest it, depending on when that happened in this mess, I probably wouldn't have done it anyway, because I was terrified for my life.
I get that. I get that. I experienced something similar in my story. And you, first of all, fear. And when you've experienced, when you've seen what this human being is capable of, and they have threatened you, so you know that this person can potentially end my life. You are very controlled by that fear, and you go along with that fear. And then I don't know what it's like for you today, but I had like definitely a decade where I deeply regretted that I did not proceed in different ways in my own story against one of my perpetrators. Like, I was so regretful, but I'm not anymore, because I was like, I was so young. What was I supposed to do? I was so controlled by fear. And let's face it, these people were dangerous. These men, they were dangerous. So it makes sense that we were terrified of them. Would it happen today, and would we deal with things in a different way? Of course we would. And I say of course, like with confidence, but it's because I'm thinking now we've learned something from our life experience, so we likely would. But the thing is, when the mind is traumatized and you are just in fight or flight mode, you just want to survive, you just never know how you're going to respond to threat, right?
Yeah, and I mean, conversation for another time, but to that point, I have had things that have happened to me since that I was sure I would handle differently, but I went right back to being frozen. And it's like, oh my God, with all this education and with all this experience and with all these years and with all this maturity and all this stuff, and yet still I froze. So it's just so hard to know. Like, now I definitely did different other things differently. I talked about it sooner. I talked about the things I'm referencing loosely right now in therapy. Like, so there were other things that I did different, but in the moment when I was in survival mode, did I do anything different? No.
No. Yeah, and we also have to remember that no matter the level of education you have, no matter how highly intelligent you are, emotionally intelligent you are, once that survival mechanism turns on, all of that, there's no reasoning, there's no logical thinking, there's nothing is left. It's a matter of life and death. There is no fucking time to think or anything. The body takes over and it does what it does to survive. And for many of us, that looks like freezing, And that's out of our control. That's why I also corrected myself before, because knowing better, that doesn't matter if you're in it, have like a gun to your head. It like I did in my case when I was 30, like with the amount of trauma I had before then, no, I was not prepared for a fucking gun to my head. Who the fuck is ever?
Exactly.
No one is.
Gosh, we're so hard on ourselves, eh?
We are, and we need to cut ourselves some slack, because my God, there are dangerous people out there, and the body just does what it can to survive, And sometimes that looks like fawning, other times it looks like freezing, then it looks like fleeing, then it looks like fighting, and in my case, it can look like a little bit of combination of of all the things at once.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally. Oh my goodness. And I just want to say, you had said about speaking to a professional one day, and like, to be clear, I have a therapist I see every 3 weeks for everything else going on. It's just, this is just the one thing I haven't touched on. But that being said, for me personally, and to each their own, but for me personally, it's really when I connect with other survivors that I feel seen and heard and understood. I am a therapist, but I'm also the first one to say that guess what? I can walk into a space and be in somebody's energy field and know this fast if they're going to get me or not. And so that's part in choosing who to open up to and who to connect with and who to share with. And I have always felt the safest with people who have been through something similar, some not necessarily people that have a whole bunch of degrees on the wall, because
No.
that only gets you so far.
It does. It does. And I absolutely feel the same way. Connecting with fellow survivors is just, it's something else. You can't really compare it to anything else. I mean, if you find a therapist that is really great at what they're doing, they can really help you, and they can help you go deep, and they can create safety. But sitting down with another survivor that really gets it, that is something else. It is.
Like the one of the suggestions I have for people if they're not ready for therapy, aside from writing to yourself, even your younger self or just your current self, or you could even write to a therapist if that helps. But another thing is, when I created my book Instagram account, that was life-changing. I just created it in June that just passed. And I cannot tell you how much healing I have had from just creating my book Instagram account. Like, from because it's full of the only people I follow are other survivors or other or agencies that deal with, these types of things. And the posts and the sense of community and belonging, like it feels, I feel more connected to some of these complete strangers, let's be clear. Haven't even had a conversation with them like I've had with you, but I feel more connected to them and more safe in their presence than I do with close friends in my actual life, to some degree, So
Oh,
I don't
I
know.
get it. I get it. I get it, 'cause I feel the same way. Absolutely. So when I came up with this whole idea about the podcast, I had no idea that I would be getting something out of it too. That had
Yeah,
not crossed my
exactly.
mind. But having all these amazing conversations, they give me life. It's so healing, and it's so affirming. Jesus Christ, this is not because there's something wrong with me or because I'm a fucking nutter. No, there are crazy people out there, and every time I have a conversation with one of you, I'm affirmed. Oh my God, people are insane, and here's another person that survived insanity, you know. So I really get you.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. So I don't know, there are just so many ways. Like, and again, I'm not saying not for people not to have professional therapy. I'm a big supporter, like absolutely do that. And there are so many other ways. Like, if you're not ready for that, there are so many other ways. And sometimes just sitting back on something like Instagram and watching other people's posts and stories, that's healing in itself, right?
And I think it's so beautiful that you just shared that, because not everyone can afford therapy. And I know in the States that CPTSD is not even acknowledged. So like paying for treatments, and that's like super expensive. So to know that, hey, there are communities on Instagram, there's even the Healing and CPTSD Foundation, where you can, sorry, I can't remember how much it is per month, but it's not very much. You can be a part of that community, and it's the same, you know, you get to speak with fellow survivors. So thank you so much for mentioning that. Can I just, do you mind if the audience knows what your Instagram is
Yeah,
so they
I
can
would
find
love
you?
that.
And
Yes.
I'm gonna find you too. So I'm just gonna, yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. So NO period.
N.
Like, okay, so it's the title of my book and my name. So NO period. And then the word ordinary, ORIDANY period. Love, LO. Do you have it? You look.
Yeah, I got it. I just followed you.
Okay.
Okay, maybe you should just say it
Oh
for
yeah.
the audience
Yeah,
so they
sorry.
can find
Okay,
you.
so it's the title of the book, which is No Ordinary Love. So no period, ordinary period, love, underscore BB period, Gabriel, GABRIEL. So it's the name of my book with a bunch of periods, underscore my name, BB
And
underscore Gabriel.
I'm gonna add it to the episode description, so you can
Okay.
just go there and click on
Awesome. Thank you.
it.
It's so funny to try to read these things out when you don't, when you're not doing it on a pen and a paper.
Bibi, thank you so much for being here. I want to read your book. I'm now I follow you. I'm so proud of you. This was your first
Was my
episode
first one speaking
ever.
out loud.
You're incredible. You did so, I mean, you can't really not do well, but you did so great. And you spoke with such confidence. And just thank you for shining your light. Thank you for not staying silent.
Thank you. Thank you for doing everything you do for all of us. Like, we need more people like you. So thank you so
Oh,
much.
you're so welcome. That was it for today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to rate Alchemical Voices and follow the community on Instagram. Until next time.